Melissa, it's great speaking with you.
Thank you so much for having me.
You helped to lead campus and community responses to the 2014 Isla Vista tragedy in which six UCSB students were killed, and you were a liaison between family and friends of the victims and the university administration. Could you please share with us your experience and your role in response to that tragedy?
Yeah, so after the tragedy occurred, I was a history I am a history PhD student, and some of my students from my class asked if I could help save some of the memorial items left at Spontaneous Memorials in Isla Vista. And so we ended up doing that, and I began a project that involved the library, history, and student affairs, and started working with the Student Affairs Administration that way. There are a number of other ways too, like different workshops we did to help teaching assistants know how to assist their undergrad students and things like that. And then for the past 6 years, I've helped with the memorial anniversary events when the families have come to our campus, and helped with students who wanted to do things for the memorials. But yeah, so I kind of segued into doing free speech work this past year and have moved that direction.
Can you talk about your presentations on the topics of proactive responses to free speech community controversies and campus responses to violence and your overall project in dealing with free speech?
Yeah, so there's a number of conferences I've had the great opportunity to present at regarding free speech with Margaret Clewoon, our Vice Chancellor of Student Affairs, and the EOP Director, Aaron Jones, and then our Director of the Multicultural Center, Savini Conmarcus, who's now retiring. We were able to present in New Orleans on proactive responses to free speech community controversies and help other university leaders think about things they can do on their campus to help improve campus climate and help further civic discourse and things like that. And so that's one thing we've been doing. And then also regarding the tragedy with our Assistant Vice Chancellor of Student Affairs and Dean of Students, Katya Armistead, we presented up in Portland, Oregon on campus responses to violence. Down in San Diego as a fellow, I was able to present at the Student Affairs Law Conference on cyberbullying and doxing and ways that campuses can try and help respond to those issues. So there's been, yeah, a number of conferences I've gotten to participate in the last few years, which have been really enriching for me.
Can you please clarify your personal stance on free speech? Do you see a need for greater freedom of expression, or do you see a role for more restrictions?
Well, that's always a tough question. I guess I would say my toolkit and a lot of the work I've done is helping student affairs administrators think about ways they can respond to offensive or hateful language and speech on campus by thinking about using their own voice as administrators. Like our Vice Chancellor of Student Affairs has done a really great job with that, denouncing when there have been really hateful incidents and things, and talking about bringing the community together. So I guess the way that I would put it is I'm not absolutist when it comes to free speech, in terms of thinking that there should be certain parameters that we set in terms of still wanting to uphold these ideas of equal educational opportunities, and really recognizing that speech is not just abstract floating in the air. It really has different impacts depending on the bodies we live in, right? Some of us are marked differently in terms of race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, religion, all of these things. So frequently when these free speech community controversies hit a campus, it's often the marginalized students who really get the brunt of some of the difficult emotion and reactions to like provocative conservative speakers who come. So I would say there are some people like American Civil Liberties Union who are very absolutist and don't want any restrictions. I tend to be a little bit more in the middle. Like,
it's interesting, it's not so much a left-right divide. I mean, there are these like conservative free speech activists, but my observation is people on who are politically on the left, there's also a division there.
Yeah, that's true.
So there were controversies with past speakers, including Milo Yiannopoulos when he spoke at UCSB. And there has been a debate about whether universities should fund controversial speakers. taking into account reactions. You were talking about potential emotional impacts, but as far as just the financial aspects and taking both into account, so this was not so much an issue with Milo, but when Ben Shapiro spoke at UC Berkeley, there were issues there. So taking into account the cost for security that is higher for a more controversial speaker, do you think the responsibility and accountability should be placed more on the speakers for that controversy, or how the reactions to the speakers in regards to whether the campus should take that risk, that security risk?
Yeah, so one thing I guess I would say is a lot of people don't realize that public institutions really have to provide, you know, free speech opportunities, platforms in a way in which it's very hard for administration to say no to speakers, right? Because we're public, we're an extension of the government in that sense. And so what ends up happening is a lot of people get upset, like, how could you let these speakers come to our campus? But in a lot of ways, the universities, even if they think someone even more extreme, I would use like Richard Spencer perhaps as an example, right? Because being a very more extreme alt-right white nationalist, it's really hard for campuses to legally be able to say no. And then, as you mentioned, the security costs can be so high that when Milo Yiannopoulos was coming to UC Berkeley, and then there was also a whole free speech week that they were planning with Ann Coulter, and it ended up not happening. But in that one year, UC Berkeley spent millions just on dealing with the free speech issues on their campus. So it's really hard, especially when we think about coronavirus, financially, how campuses are being impacted right now. So different campuses are approaching it in different ways. They're coming up with creative ideas. So like at UCLA, they're going to have a cap saying there's $500,000 that is set aside by the university for student orgs to be able to access if they are going to have high security costs for a really controversial speaker to come to their campus. And it's first come, first serves. So like by the end of the school year, you know, that $500,000, if it's 9 months in and the security costs have all been tapped into, well, that's it. Other student orgs that want to be able to bring a controversial speaker with high security costs, they've just waited too long. So one way to go about it is to actually set a cap so that it's not, it's content neutral. It's not based on, are they left wing, are they right wing, like who's the speaker? It's just based on extraordinary security costs.
Legally, to what degree do First Amendment rights apply to universities as state-sponsored institutions? I mean, are there specific codes that are dealing with speech that some could find offensive or hostile? So basically, like, yeah, the campus codes of conduct that might deal with harassment, and how do they match up with overall, like, legal protections under the First Amendment?
Yeah, great question. So one of the things that tends to be very troubling for folks is that, you know, you come to the university, they have certain things written on their campus website about non-discrimination. There's wonderful creeds or value statements, right? Pledges where students are saying they're not going to be discriminatory against other people or intolerant, and thinking about, you know, saying how it's going to be such a supportive environment on campus. Well, those don't really hold any sort of legal, you know, weight in the way in which the First Amendment does and applies in institutions. And so universities, the Supreme Court has said, have an even stronger responsibility to really uphold First Amendment rights. And so that's why I've been saying, like, it's hard for administrators to really prohibit these speakers from coming, even if they know they're going to be inflammatory and perhaps even bringing violence. Like at Seattle, you know, there was someone who was shot and survived, but at Seattle when Milo went up there to speak. So, you know, it's not just speech, as we're seeing right now in the national news with Kenosha and with Portland and all of these places. You know, we talk about it as though it's speech, but people are losing their lives, right? So I will say in the state of California, it's a little unusual in that we have something called the Leonard Law, which means that even for private colleges and universities, they still have to uphold First Amendment to the same way that public institutions are held. So very robust protections around free speech in California.
How does one define the definition of a hate speech, starting with obvious blatant examples such as threats or slurs, but then a kind of much broader spectrum, the whole debate about who decides where to draw the line, because obviously different parties have their own personal political biases, so who decides what speech is offensive, and then what is a legitimate discussion in an open debate? Is there any kind of agreed upon consensus of what is classified as a hate speech, or how much of that is objective?
Yeah, so we talk as a society a lot about hate speech, and it makes sense in that we can often recognize something that we find to be hateful, intolerant, offensive. Maybe it's discriminatory about race, ethnicity, gender, sexual orientation, religion. Like, there's things that people, I think, in more of a kind of general consensus way, will feel like that crossed a line, like that is hateful. But under the law, you don't actually have hate speech as recognized under the First Amendment. So there's no delineation. It never mentions hate speech as a concept or a category. So it's not as though hate speech is somehow unlawful or prohibited. And so that's what creates, I think, a lot of confusion for folks, is they feel like, how can our chancellor, or how can our university administration allow so-and-so to come speak on our campus? Or like the Unite the Right rally, you might remember in Charlottesville, right, where people were holding torches at the University of Virginia campus. A lot of people get very upset at university administrators and say, well, that's hate speech, but really the First Amendment doesn't make any kind of exception or carve out for hate speech itself.
You're differentiating between what is legally how it's legally classified and how it might personally impact someone.
Yeah, in the sense that it just isn't even mentioned. Hate speech doesn't actually appear when we look at the Constitution, when we look at the First Amendment. It's not even mentioned. So nowadays, like in terms of just practicality, common sense, we'll say, you know, that's hate speech right there. But it doesn't mean it's actually prohibited. The, you know, protections around First Amendment, especially, like I say, college campuses, is so robust that having hate speech doesn't mean it's somehow not going to be allowed on a campus. So that's why, like with my toolkit, the conferences I've been able to present at with administrators, is really thinking about, okay, well, you know, if it's not as though something's going to be prohibited because it's hateful, what can we do to work around that, speak back, and have maybe alternative other events students can attend, or have like a kind of marketing, other messaging campaign. I don't know how long you've been on campus, but we had like a hate-free UCSB campaign that happened a few years ago. So yeah, so I sometimes say hateful speech and kind of talk about it that way, since hate speech itself is not really meaning anything under the law.
Melissa, is there anything else you'd like to add?
Well, I guess I would just say it's been an amazing opportunity for me as a grad student to be able to work both with student activists and to be able to be working with the university administration the past few years. It's been really an amazing thing to have kind of my foot in both worlds. And I appreciate student activism and hope that it's going to continue to be embraced as part of students learning, you know, about how they can make an impact in the world. Yeah.
Melissa, it was excellent speaking with you with KCSB News. This is Robert Stark.